From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie and welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, connecting with consciousness. Now, this is going to be interesting, especially with my views on consciousness and coincidence and all that. So make sure you're part of the program. Here's what's happening. Starbucks Coffee Company has removed certain breakfast sandwiches from 250 locations because of possible contamination with Listeria. The sandwiches were made by the Progressive Gourmet Company of Wilmington, Massachusetts, and they may have been heated at Starbucks locations for immediate consumption or sold to consumers for consumption later, according to a recall notice by the FDA. The manufacturer has recalled its 6-ounce sausage, egg, cheddar cheese, English muffin sandwiches after its in-house testing procedures detected Listeria on a contact surface and its production plant. The city of Cleveland is seeking to buy 2,000 sets of riot gear, including riot control suits and collapsible batons, as part of the city's latest move to spend a $50 million federal security grant for July's Republican National Convention. And foreign diplomats are expressing alarm to U.S. government officials about what they say are inflammatory and insulting public statements by Republican presidential frontrunner Donald Trump. Boy, they're coming at him from all angles. Officials from Europe, the Middle East, Latin America, and Asia have now complained in recent private conversations, mostly about the nature of Trump's statements. A U.S. airstrike has killed more than 150 al-Shabaab militants in Somalia. A spokesperson for our country said the strike hit a training camp where a large-scale attack was being planned. North Korea has issued its latest belligerent threat, warning now of a preemptive nuclear strike of justice against, as I had last night, but now they pinpointed cities, Washington, D.C., and Seoul, South Korea. This time, they say, in reaction, of course, to the start of the huge U.S.-South Korean military drills. Now, this is not the first time they've threatened this during these drills, but let's check in with Charles R. Smith. He is our expert on North Korea. More rhetoric, Charles, or is this getting tense?
Absolutely more rhetoric. However, we can expect them to increase operations on other fronts. For example, the Bureau 121 apparently has been active. That's the North Korean hacker unit. And they apparently have attempted to hack into South Korea's railway system. They've also had some reports of them trying to hack into the cell phones of South Korean leadership. So I would expect to see some activity in reaction to the exercises, but the North really doesn't believe for a moment, or actually nobody would believe for a moment, that the South Koreans and the United States would want to invade North Korea simply because to topple the regime would be extremely costly. I'm not talking about military-wise. I'm talking about kind of like what happened after East Germany fell. It'll cost about $1 trillion. Mm-hmm. To turn North Korea into something close to what a Western country would be. And, of course, the South Koreans are frightened to death that the North regime will collapse.
Charles, I was a kid when Khrushchev was at the United Nations. He took his shoes off and he's smashing them on the table going, "We will bury you," and things like that. I got to ask you this. I mean, if Russia today, if Putin today said, look, we're going to nuke Washington, it's our first spot if these things get out of hand, or if China would say that, I think we'd take that seriously. Why aren't we apparently taking this guy seriously in North Korea?
The North Koreans are notorious for making these kinds of statements again and again. It's really kind of a sad news propaganda. Think of it as still crazy after all these years. What we kind of look at in more or less in terms of looking at, say, China or Russia is the activity of their strategic nuclear forces. And it's funny you mention that because the Russians have recently increased the activities of their missile-firing submarines, the SLBM submarines coming off the east and west coasts, which is sort of a renewal of patrols that they did during the Cold War. The problem with that is that nuclear-tipped missiles on submarines that close in is a first strike threat. It is not a retaliation kind of thing.
Now, if we did a preemptive strike against North Korea, is anybody going to jump in to stop us?
No, but I don't think that it would be wise, as I illustrated before, if you topple the regime, the afterwards is what the problem is.
Right.
In order to... North Korea is such a basket case, it would cost nearly $1 trillion to bring its people into nearly the 20th century, much less where they currently are. So, again, the South Koreans would be the first ones telling us, let's not do this, simply because they don't have the money to, help rebuild the North into something close to Western civilization. They saw what happened to Germany when it absorbed East Germany. It took years, decades, for the systems to come online. Well, you can imagine what it would be like with the North Koreans, who are even more... basically, it would be the South Koreans looking at us saying, don't do this.
Don't do it.
Maybe it's not such a good idea. And the Chinese are deathly afraid of seeing the North Korean regime fall as well, simply because, again, they would have to pay huge amounts of sums of money in order to stem a tide of refugees flowing over the borders.
Okay, Charles, keep watching that situation for us. There's a lot of saber-rattling going out there, and I don't know, I just feel as if it's getting tense. And this guy in North Korea, of course, Kim Jong-un, when you keep threatening, we're going to take out this city and that. They do videos now, nuke videos, videos of cities being taken out by them. Something's got to be done. Binge drinking, at least 6 cocktails in one night, may raise the risk of cardiovascular events, including heart attacks and strokes, over the following week, according to research. They now say even one drink associated with higher odds of cardiovascular problems over the next 24 hours. Now, this is where it gets confusing. They say, however, people who have had 2 or 4 alcoholic drinks may actually experience a lower risk of heart attack and stroke over the next week than those who have no drinks. So, you can't drink more than 6. You can't drink just 1. But it's okay to drink 2 to 4. Just remember that the next time you go out. Jeez. The roughly 8,000-year-old hands painted on a rock wall in the Sahara Desert are not human. Don't get all excited now. They are the hands and forefeet of the desert monitor lizard, according to a study. But they sure look weird. The planet Mercury may once have been encased in an outer shell of graphite, the same material used as pencil lead. And now it's time to check in with Stephen Cates, Dr. Sky, because lots going on in the skies these days.
Absolutely, George. Good to be with you and the Coast audience here. It's amazing. Some 46 years ago, to be exact, I saw my first total solar eclipse, like many did, in Perry, Florida, back on March the 7th of 1970. I was just 14. But, George, what makes this even more prolific is we're only 16 hours away for the folks on the other side of the Earth to see a similar kind of rare event. Now, along the path, George, that it takes across the Pacific, obviously it's mostly water, so nothing but fish or ships at sea probably can experience it. But I want to make note of this. For our listeners in the state of Hawaii and also in Alaska, in Honolulu, tomorrow the eclipse will be very deep as a partial eclipse, so pay attention to this, folks. You don't want to stare directly at the sun naturally, but around 5:36 p.m. local time in Honolulu, the sun is some 14 degrees above the Hawaiian sky. In Anchorage, Alaska, it's 6:12 p.m. local time. The sun will only be some 3 degrees high in the sky. But George, what's interesting about this eclipse, it's called the full or total supermoon solar eclipse, and it ends the day before it begins, which is really strange. It actually starts, as we mentioned, over in Asia, that is March the 9th, then backwards it goes across the international dateline, thus back to the 8th, a very strange type of eclipse. But what's really interesting about this event is that we rarely get to see this. So if you're at a computer and you're going to miss the totality, you probably want to log on to a lot of webcams that are going to be doing this probably around 6 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And Jupiter, what you can see, I should say, in the skies, George, is Jupiter's at its best right now. It's at opposition, some 413 million miles away. Take a look with telescopes. The great spacecraft Juno is on its way to Jupiter. It arrives on July the 4th. And George, we get so many requests for our aviation and photo recon side of the house. Just wanted to remind everyone, if you're in the Las Vegas area and you happen to be seeing a lot of military activity, the red flag exercises continue. And George, what's cool about that is right in the center of the red flag activity is, of course, Area 51. And we have a nice update with our photo team of what's happening with all that in the sky and so much more to come in March. Good to be with you.
Thank you, Dr. Sky, Stephen Cates. Michigan Governor Rick Snyder has stood firm after Democratic presidential hopefuls Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders called for his resignation over the Flint water crisis. The city's water became contaminated when lead leached from old pipes after a change in the supplier back in 2014. Some 100,000 people were affected there. Up next, contamination. McKay Jenkins joins us, and we're going to be talking about his story. It's an incredible story. Well, you're just going to have to hear it when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back to Coast. George Norrie with you. Right before the break, I was talking about the Flint, Michigan water system. Well, wait till you hear this story. McKay Jenkins holds degrees from Amherst College, Columbia's Graduate School of Journalism, and Princeton. He received a Ph.D. in English there. After experiencing a health scare of his own, and he'll tell you about that, he set out to discover the truth about toxic chemicals and the alarming exposure that we all face and our government's failure to regulate them. He discovered that he'd spent his life marinating in toxic stuff, from his wall-to-wall carpeting to his dryer sheets to his drinking water. But thank God he's lived to talk about it, and he wrote the book called Contamination. McKay, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Back. It's been a while. Good to have you with us. You know, this Flint story seems to be out of control. Didn't they know this was going to happen?
Well, I think that in a legal sense is actually a real question. It's who knew what when, and that's why you're seeing so many regulators and politicians taking so much heat, because the question is, did the state, did the city, did the EPA, what did they know and when did they know it? That's really a big question for who takes responsibility. But there's actually a deeper thing, which is, what was lead doing in these pipes in the first place? You know, we've known since the Roman era, at least, that lead was not a good idea to have anywhere near drinking water. They knew that thousands of years ago. So what are we doing, creating infrastructure for, you know, municipal size drinking water supplies with a contaminant that we knew was a problem thousands of years ago? That goes way beyond who's responsible. In this case, we have to think about industrial cities all over the country. My bet is that you're going to start to see this story repeat itself over and over again, especially in the Rust Belt and in industrial East Coast cities where, I mean, I live in Baltimore, and the water infrastructure here is falling apart. I mean, it's the sewer system, the drinking water supply system, all the infrastructure is so old, and it's all rotting. And, you know, these things that are built into the system are going to start rearing their ugly heads, I think, all over the country.
I think you're right. And it's just ludicrous that they did not think about this. Somebody should have said, hey, there's got to be lead in these old pipes somewhere. Let's check this first. And they didn't. And if they knew that, then they're really culpable.
Well, think about this. I mean, we've known since the 90s, we've banned lead. Like, lead has not been allowed in things like gasoline or paint for 40 years. But, you know, anybody who knows about lead knows that lead was used in water pipes for a long time. So what were they thinking that they would, you know, granted, this is a billion or trillion dollar fix for each one of these cases. But, you know, it's not like this is a surprise. People know and have known for decades that there's lead in our infrastructure.
Now, your investigation into toxic chemicals started with a very serious health scare for yourself. Tell us what happened.
Well, a few years ago, I went to see my primary care physician with what I thought was a running injury. I had some pain in my left side between my hip and my knee. And he said, you know, it's probably just a ligament tear. Why don't you go see an orthopedist about that? So I did and went in, and the orthopedist said, yeah, it looks familiar. Why don't we'll get you an MRI and everything probably will be okay. At the time I was about 43 years old, I think, and pretty fit, honestly, fit and healthy and, mm-hmm. and you know, good diet, all that kind of stuff. So I went in and had an MRI, and lo and behold, it turned up a baseball-sized tumor in my abdomen, right between my hip bone and my pelvic bone. So, of course, I freaked out, and my wife and I had two very little children at the time, and, you know, made all the frantic phone calls. What is this thing? How did it get there? You know, what does it mean for me? They thought that most likely it was what they call a soft tissue sarcoma, which is a malignancy that grows out of a muscle cell. And it was pretty bad, and it was, you know, right in the wheelhouse of my whole body. So it was pretty clear that we needed to get this thing taken care of. So I got myself onto the schedule of a surgeon up in New York City, and while I was in my scrubs waiting to go into the operating room, some researchers came up to me, and they said, do you mind if we ask you some questions about your chemical exposure? And I said, I can't even imagine what you mean. I've been a journalist and a college professor my whole life. I mean, I've never worked in an industrial plant. I've never, you know, made paint or whatever, you know, would expose you to these sorts of things. And I said, no, we're not really talking about that. We're talking about consumer products. Like, you know, think about, have you ever been exposed to, like, the chemicals in carpeting or in paint or in upholstery or in water bottles or in, you know, varnishes? And I said, of course I have. Everybody has. This stuff is everywhere all day long. And they said, well, what about things like lotions and shampoos and soaps and detergents? I said, of course I have. You know, who is?
My God, everybody is. Yeah.
Right. So anyway, these were the questions that were being asked of me literally like minutes before I went in for the surgery. You know, my head was already spinning, and now I needed some anesthesia just to get through those questions. So I go in for the surgery, and they open me up and pull this thing out. And when I come to hours later, they said, well, there's some good news. We see about 100 of these tumors a year, and 96 of them are malignant. But you drew the long straw, I guess, because mine was benign.
Wow.
It turned out that once they did a biopsy on this thing, it turned out it wasn't growing out of a muscle cell. It was growing out of a nerve cell. Of course, they wouldn't have known that until they got it out, and lo and behold, it was benign. But nonetheless, I was lucky, and I came to, and it took me, you know, about 4 months to recover from the surgery and everything. But then I was left with all these questions, like, what were they after there? What were those questions? What did they think I had? Where did they think all these things?
Yeah, they were on a mission.
They were looking for something.
Yeah.
And it occurred to me that, you know, I and everybody else is walking through our daily lives with these products around us that have been, that are now completely ubiquitous. And the moment you wake up in the morning and take a shower to, you know, what you are exposed to in your kitchen or in your bathroom or in your car on your way to work, or when you're exposed to chemicals in the Xerox machine at work, or whether it's the paint that's being put on the walls of your office building or whatever it is, all day long, there's things you're coming into contact with. And these chemicals, you know, once I started doing the research, it turns out that these chemicals have not really been around that long, nor have the consumer products that they're put in. You know, we're talking about a matter of decades only for some of them. And the reason that's important to think about is that they're absolutely everywhere. And at the same time, you know, science has not really kept up with the quick birth and evolution of all these chemicals. So they've been around for a very short time, and the science that would tell us whether or not these things are dangerous has been around a very short time too. So, you know, if your neighbor is spraying herbicides all over their grass every spring to kill their dandelions or their clover, and the, you know, the wind blows that stuff into your kitchen, and you can actually test it, you can swab your windowsill and get these chemicals and put them in the laboratory, and they can tell you that your neighbor's pesticides are now in your kitchen, which means you're breathing them.
You're breathing it in, sure.
All that kind of stuff. So, but the point here is that we don't really know. Like, the chemicals are everywhere, and science hasn't really kept up with trying to figure out whether or not these things are individually bad for us or collectively once they build up in our system or they get into combination with other chemicals in our system. So what we're trying to do now is figure out you know, how to keep an eye on this stuff, because the industries that make them are vast and very powerful. And as you know, you go into any big box store and there are products everywhere that you look that are made with things that are not on any labels. They're almost all made out of petrochemicals. That we come into intimate contact with them.
Hold on for a second, McKay. We're at the break already, but we're going to come back and talk about this. And also, you invited a toxicologist to do some examining around your home. We'll talk about that too. And welcome back. McKay Jenkins with us. His book, Contamination, I'll spell it, by the way, Contami, and the nation, used to be called What's Gotten Into Us. When did you make that change, McKay?
Well, they decided that they wanted to kind of make it more widely available in a paperback. So What's Gotten Into Us was the hardcover title, and then when they released it as a paperback, they decided to give it a new title.
That's a good idea. Now, you had a toxicologist come to your home. Tell me why and what did they find?
Well, so the purpose of this whole project was to figure out how we get exposed to all these chemicals. And there are different chapters in the book about different ways that we get exposed. And the first thought I had was, let's get a guy in here who knows what he's talking about to just walk room by room and point things out. So normally when you have a home inspection, a guy comes in and tells you your roof is good or it's not good and your foundation is good or it's not good. In this case, I just wanted somebody to go room by room and say, like, what kinds of things could my children or my wife or I be exposing ourselves to without even realizing?
Without even knowing.
So he, for example, then looks under the cabinets in the kitchen and says, you know, you're using all these different, that's a problem. Actually, one of the things he does that's really a cool visual is he tells his clients to gather up all of the things that they have in their house that you can spray. So anything that's like an aerosol spray, mm-hmm. or anything that smells, whether it's a clean product or whatever it is, put it all in a plastic bag, put a knot around the bag, and let it sit there for a week or 2 weeks or a month. And then at the end of that, open the bag up and put your face in there and take a big, deep breath. And you can just imagine all of the off-gassing that's coming from all these products. You would get a big face full of it all at once. And, of course, the idea there is that this stuff, you know, whether you're doing it at once or just moment by moment, day by day, you're getting exposed to this stuff all day long. It's just ambient in the air. It's ambient on the surfaces of your house. So that's a problem. Then he would take you into, in our case, like our basement. And he goes, even walking into the basement, he says, you don't smell what I'm smelling? I was like, what are you talking about? Of course, I'd been so used to it, I didn't even really get it anymore. He said, what's going on down there? I said, well, you know, there's some old paint down there and some varnishes and
But they were covered, right? You had the lids on them, I assume.
Well, exactly. But, you know, how secure are those lids? And, you know, I build canoes as a hobby, and so there are all these different things down there, like epoxies and resin, mm-hmm. all this kind of stuff that you have in your workshop. And then he said also, you know, you don't think about it, but, you know, human beings for thousands of years used to cook outside. They would cook over a fire. Now we cook inside. So whether you have an electric stove or you have a gas stove, you're especially if it's a gas stove, you're venting all the, you know, the carbon monoxide that is used to burn the flames. And, of course, we all have our heating systems inside our house. So we've got furnaces that are burning oil or furnaces that are burning gas. We've got carbon monoxide coming up there. If you have an indoor garage, if you have a built-in garage and you warm up your car in the garage and, you know, on a cold winter day and you're in the, you know, finishing your coffee, but your car is meanwhile venting all of its fumes under the house that's now going up into your kid's bedroom, like all these different sources of things
that you don't think about.
You never think about it. Of course, I had never thought about this, and none of us do. And it takes an expert sometimes to point out the obvious. And it was very, very instructive to me. And, you know, I made some good changes. You know, there are things that you wouldn't ever think about, like, you know, you want to cook an egg on a Teflon pan because you like the idea that it won't stick. Turns out the Teflon is really a...
Well, I think we lost you. You there? Call him back, Tommy. He's gone. He is gone. Pumped it. Was that him or was that our system? It's him, you think. Okay, we'll see if we can. That was a very strange pop, folks. And we'll try to get him back right in the middle of this. We will take calls next hour, by the way, with McKay Jenkins or with me if we have to. So get ready for that. We're talking about his book, Contamination. And what this is it's his story of toxicity that occurred. We got him back? Okay, great. There you go. Boy, you popped right off, and there you are again.
Here I am.
Okay, great.
Yeah, I was just in the middle of telling a story about Teflon. So if you cook a pan that's got Teflon on it to a certain temperature, and if you happen to have a songbird in your house, like if you have a pet parakeet or something like that, and those Teflon fumes get ambient, you will come back and find your pet bird is going to be dead. And you actually will
Oh
find
my God.
stories in newspapers all the time that it's like literally like a canary in the coal mine. Like the songbirds are so sensitive to these Teflon chemicals that you'll just find a dead bird, and you won't be like, what happened? And then you see a burning egg on the stovetop, and you realize that maybe it was the Teflon chemicals. So, these are kinds of things that are everyday products that are in our lives, and we just really don't think about them too much.
You really don't. I mean, you innocently cook on a Teflon pan, and God knows what you're ingesting when you eat it with your food.
Well, and then you get to things, very fundamental things that we think of as kind of feel-good foods, like microwave popcorn, for example. So microwave popcorn often comes in a bag that is lined with an anti-grease chemical on the inside because the company doesn't want the grease from the butter and the popcorn
To
leaking out
ooze
of the
all over
bag.
the place, yeah.
So you pop that in the microwave, it gets super hot, and what happens? Those chemicals get released into the popcorn, and those things are really bad chemicals. Now, you wouldn't think about it because you don't think about chemicals in the lining of a food bag. Or if you buy canned vegetables, the inside of those cans is coated with what's called bisphenol A, the BPA, the same stuff that used to be in plastic baby bottles.
That's
And they
right.
started testing that and found out the plastic was getting into your baby. Well, the plastic is getting into you through the vegetables when you cook them too. So this stuff is invisible, but it's everywhere. And you do this moment by moment in your life, and this stuff really adds up.
Now, what can people do going around the house trying to make things a little easier for themselves so they don't breathe this in or ingest it? What can they do?
Well, I think there's some very fundamental things that take it. It's very frustrating, I admit, and I acknowledge this. But if you start paying a little bit more attention to the stuff that you're actually buying, like this stuff is either going to make you more enlightened or more angry, or maybe both at the same time. Like if you want your, you want to clean your clothes, you want to clean your kitchen, you want to clean your teeth, whatever you want to clean, you want to look at the label of the product that you're buying and see if you can recognize what's in it. And chances are you're not going to be able to recognize anything in it
That's
because
not a good sign.
it's not a good sign. And this is really like a fundamental thing, is that information about these products, from toothpaste all the way up to varnishes, all the way up to the upholstery in your couch or whatever we're talking about, there's very little information that's available because there's no label on many of these products. And if there is a label, it's not exactly enlightening. If you, I mean, what we should talk maybe when we have some more time about things like cosmetics and personal care products, because this is stuff that we put directly on our bodies. And if you look at the labels on these things, you will find lots of marketing information, like this stuff is going to make your teeth bright and shiny, or your cheeks bright and shiny, but it doesn't tell you anything about what goes into the products. And you will find, especially with cosmetics, they're unusually lacking in information. And you can find, once you know about this stuff, that there are chemicals in cosmetics that are carcinogenic, including chemicals, weirdly, on some products that carry the pink ribbon. So there's this whole notion of what they call pink washing, where a product will have a ribbon on it that is meant to make you think that they support breast cancer research, but there are ingredients in these products that cause cancer, which is one of the most aggravating things that I've ever come across. There, in cosmetics, there's something like 400 ingredients in American cosmetics that are illegal to use in Europe because Europeans have a much tighter policy on whether these chemicals can be released into consumer products.
That's frightening. Now, in your particular case, when you got this benign tumor, which could have been accumulating and growing over how many years? What do you think?
Who can say? I mean, they said it was a slow-growing thing, but it was in me for a long time, I think.
So they got it out. Had it stayed, would it have become cancerous?
I don't think so. I mean, I think what would have happened is it would have grown to the point that it became. I mean, the reason I knew about it at all is it was pinching on a
I
nerve.
mean, it was as big as what, a baseball?
Yeah, that's when it came out. It was finally that big.
So it could have been a football if it kept growing, right?
Or
My
basketball.
God.
Yeah, and for me, I guess you could say it was fortunate that it was in a big cavity in my abdomen, but let's say it had been growing in my brain or something like that. Who can say?
Have you ever used spray, oven cleaner spray?
Never. No, never,
Let me
never.
tell you something, McKay. You spray that, and if you're not holding your breath, you're going to get these fumes that hit you. and it's almost asphyxiating. I mean, you start gagging and you can't breathe.
Well,
it's the worst.
Let's use that as an excellent example. So if that's the case, then let's just use that as an example of any product that if you can't deal with it, chances are pretty good that it's not good for you. So you mentioned earlier dryer sheets. Now, there are people with something called multiple chemical sensitivity. These are people who are acutely sensitive to all the chemicals that we're talking about, way more so than the rest of us. Dryer sheets is something that they are most sensitive to. So there are people that I interviewed for this book. When they take a walk down the street, and there's a house in their neighborhood that is using a dryer sheet, and the dryer is being vented. You know how this
outside, sure, they
yeah,
all are.
It hits them all the way out on the sidewalk. They can smell it, and they will go absolutely fall apart. These chemicals in those dryer sheets are so potent that people can feel them like 20, 30 yards
yep.
away from the dryer.
I buy unscented. Is that better?
Well, you know, this is a good question. I can't say for sure, but I know that scent, the idea of a fragrance, the fragrance, whether it's in a dryer sheet or in a scented candle or in an air freshener, the scent itself or the fragrance itself often has the most toxic ingredients in the product. So this is a strange thing to say, but if you can smell it, there's a pretty good chance that that's where a lot of the bad stuff is. So this is going to bug a lot of people, but like scented candles, if you can smell them, you know, if you go into a doctor's office and they have scented candles that are really blazing, you can smell it so much that your eyes start watering.
They're not good for you.
They're not, and the reason is they actually contain the same chemicals that go into making soft plastic water bottles. They're called phthalates, and they are hormone disruptors. So, you know, this is, you're getting exposed to hormone disruptors if you drink out of a plastic bottle, but also if you're breathing in the scented candles at your doctor's office. So this is another example of invisible contact, you don't realize you're being exposed, but pretty much wherever you go, you're getting a little bit of dose from here and a little bit of dose from there. And the question is, cumulatively, you know, at what point do you tip? They talk about what they call a barrel theory. So your body's like a barrel, and you're getting a little bit here and a little bit there, and eventually your barrel overflows, and when it overflows, that's when you get sick. So this is where the science is right now, trying to figure out how we get exposed, to what level do we get exposed, and at what point do these things start causing problems.
Well, and we're living, obviously, in a chemical era where everything has chemicals for your car, for your laundry, for your gas, for your house, for your cooking. It's everywhere.
Yeah, and, you know, it's funny because you think about things like people say what they call the new car smell. You know, you open the door of a new car. If that stuff that you're smelling is not good for you, right? That's the stuff that's in the upholstery in the car. It's in the plastic dashboard of your car. It's in the things they use to clean it. All that stuff that you associate with a nice new car, that's how common this stuff is. We associate a toxic smell with something nice, which is a really creepy thing because, you know, as we've known for a long time, smell is a very emotional sense. Like when you smell something, it gives you an emotional sense of well-being. And if we're starting to associate well-being with these toxic chemicals, then we're in trouble. Same thing if you buy a new mattress. Like you get a new mattress delivered to your house, you open up the cardboard box, you open up the plastic bag that the mattress is in, and you'll get a lungful of chemicals. A lot of that stuff is in mattresses are called flame retardants because they're built into the mattress so that I guess the theory is if you smoke in bed and fall asleep, you won't light your mattress on fire. But on the other hand, those chemicals are neurotoxins. So every night that you put your head down on the mattress, you're being exposed to neurotoxins. You have to, you know, these things are, like I say, just pretty much everywhere you go.
You got to be very careful about everything. Your pillows, what you do, and, you know, it's just everywhere. What about stuff like Windex? You know, you spray on glass, your car windshield to keep it clean. Is that okay?
Well, you know,
it's ammonia.
None of this stuff, this is obvious, right? None of this stuff is going to hurt you. Just like smoking one cigarette is not going to hurt you. The real question is, how many times in a given day, a given year, a given lifetime do you get exposed to this stuff, and what is the cumulative effect? Some things we can live without, some things we can't live without. Like, I don't know what I'm going to do if I can't have, you know, a furnace in my house. But I do know that I don't need to have a Teflon frying pan. And I do know that I don't need a scented candle to make my house smell nice. And I do know that I don't need to spray an air freshener in my house. If I want my air to be fresh, I'll open a window. You know, if I want my house to smell like an apple pie, I'll bake an apple pie, spray an apple pie. So, you know, I'm not trying to be like crazy about this. I don't think you have to eliminate like the essentials, but what we think of as essential is actually a way bigger category than it actually needs to be. We could have a whole lot less of this stuff and not really affect our lives very much.
What about these air fresheners that you plug in? You've seen those, right?
Yeah, and those things, I'm glad you asked. That's one of my most aggravating things. So like, there are a few things. That and the other one that we can talk about later is lawn chemicals, but these are motion-sensitive air fresheners you're talking about. So you go into a public restroom, you go into any public space, and there's something, or some people buy them for their house. Like you plug them in.
There's like a little bottle that is attached to it, and, you know, over time, it evaporates.
Well, right.
But it cooks. It basically cooks.
So what that stuff is doing is it's squirting these things called phthalates, again, these plastic chemicals into the atmosphere, and you're breathing them in. And when you say they evaporate, people think that because they can't see them, it means that they're not there anymore. But if you've got that little bottle and now it's empty, where do you think that stuff went? That stuff didn't disappear.
It's in our lungs.
It went into our lungs. It's now in the dust in your kitchen. Whatever it is, it's on your kitchen cabinets. So this stuff, I mean, the philosophical thing to remember is that nothing disappears. It just changes in form. And sometimes that change in form means it's now inside your body.
What would make those people who came to see you and they asked all those questions, what would make them suspect that it might have been the chemicals? Because they were obviously on a mission.
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. I think in my case, they were doing a research project into a chemical known as PCBs. So PCBs are the chemicals that were used for many, many years in industrial manufacturing of things like electrical transformers.
And plastics too, right?
Well, they're mainly used to as a like a sheath to prevent things from overheating. So if you're taking the Amtrak train or something like that, you'll see these big substations where there's a lot of intense energy, and PCBs were used to build these electrical transformers. And these are things on the East Coast. We know this because, like General Electric, the big company, was dumping PCBs into the Hudson River in New York for many, many years, and now the entire river has these PCBs all through the base of the river. And the big debate is whether the company should be forced to dredge these PCBs up and get them out, these really toxic contaminants, out of a major East Coast river. So PCB exposure, I think, might have been what they were looking for, but they asked me, you know, scores of questions, not just about PCBs, but like I said, about all these consumer things. So I'm not sure, you know, when you're doing a research project, you go fishing, you're just looking for anything to try to follow a thread. And I don't know what they were specifically looking for, but I think they asked me these questions because all these things can lead to problems.
And McKay, when they made these things, didn't these chemists know or understand that these things could be toxic?
Well, this is a very important question, and, you know, the answer in some cases is yes, and the answer in some cases is no. So when you're, you know, the model that people always talk about is the tobacco industry. So people at some point in the tobacco industry knew that tobacco caused lung cancer. They knew that, and we all know that they knew that, and it finally took 30 years for them finally to admit it and to be held responsible for it. But, you know, there are other things, like when you look at some of these lawn chemicals, this is like the Rachel Carson legacy of all these pesticides that people sprayed. When they were inventing things like DDT or something, you know, you have these crazy stories of a scientist saying, look, I'll prove to you that it's safe. And he would like eat a spoonful of it or something like that. And he would live. And so he'd say, see, or they would dump it in a bucket of fish and say, oh, look, the fish are still alive a day later. And these primitive tests were like foolishly naive. And they'd say, look, it's no problem. Now the thing is that these industries are often completely self-regulating. So whether you're talking about pesticides or any of these other consumer products, the federal oversight, the federal regulators tell the companies, look, you guys do your own testing, and when you find out that it's okay, tell us, and we'll basically rubber stamp it. So there's really no one watching the hen house here. This is a lot of these chemicals are being manufactured by the same companies that are testing them, and therefore we're all left basically to distrust that things are going to be okay.
Absolutely. McKay, stay with us. We're going to come back in a moment and take phone calls, and I'm sure we're going to get many. McKay Jenkins with us, his work, Contamination, Contami, the nation. Different way to spell it, isn't it? Well, we're breathing it, we're smelling it, we're eating it. It's all over the place. We'll be back with your calls next on Coast to Coast AM.